Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Twyla Tharp has had an astonishing career. She has choreographed more than 160 works, live dance performances, television specials, movies, full-length ballets, and figure skating routines, earning a Tony, two Emmys, a MacArthur Genius Grant, and the National Medal of the Arts, among dozens of other honors. She is a best-selling author with books on the story of her life, on creativity, and on the value of collaboration. Tharp has kept this pace up for half a century, and it seems she's just getting started. To celebrate the 50th anniversary of her life as a choreographer, she is taking a company of 12 dancers on the road for 10 weeks to perform works commissioned by a partnership of acclaimed arts organizations, including Titus in Dallas. The first audience to see that 50th anniversary tour will be at the AT&T Performing Arts Center, where we're broadcasting today from the Nancy B. Hammond Hall in the Winspear Opera House. We have a live audience, as you can hear, at the Winspear. The program makes its world premiere as a presentation of Titus on Friday with an encore presentation Saturday before moving on to cities including Chicago, Washington, D.C., and New York. Twyla Tharp, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much.
How long have you been thinking about your 50th anniversary?
50 years.
Is it something that as a young choreographer you thought, if I'm doing this in 50 years, I'm going to do something amazing?
I don't know about amazing, but I thought it would be wise to keep moving along.
For many people, the opportunity to do anything is a little paralyzing. Did you first start with what you wanted to do, or did you have to pare away what you knew you wouldn't do?
Well, first of all, I think more paralyzing is having the opportunity to do nothing. So it's, you know, one step in front of the next, and that's what you do. I mean, you don't look miles down the road and see humongous mountains. It's just one step, and you can do that.
Some artists in your position might have taken this as the perfect opportunity to look back, to restage successful works from the past. Why didn't that interest you?
Because I've already done that, and because the point of work is, to me, doing more work. There's always time for the past, and I value the past, not only my past but others' past, but it's the future's got lots of room for the past. The present has only now.
What would you say is your... What would you say is your relationship to history, the history of dance and to your own history?
I am an art historian. My degree is from Barnard in art history. So I have a sense of context that what I do exists in a very, very large parameter, that it has a future, not according basically to circumstance, and that one hopes to be of use as a link. That's what it is to study art history, to move from one artist to the next, from one mode of thought to another, and also, of course, to see a culture reflected in its arts.
How much did you have to know before you felt that you could begin to make the connections that played into your own creativity?
I need that question in another way.
Did you start studying art history and studying dance, and was there a moment at which you thought, okay, I've been exposed to enough different ideas, enough ways of thinking and creating that I see connections between things that I didn't see before, I can make new connections?
In my case, I have always to say I'm my mother's daughter, and my mother gave me an extraordinary education, beginning with keyboard lessons outside the house when I was 2 years old. And from there it moved on into all kinds of formats in the arts, musical, painting, literary, dramatic, plus which we always had the drive-in. My mother ran and owned a movie house where I began working when I was 8 years old and continued till I went away to college. So I saw at least 8 and sometimes 10 cartoons a week to learn the reality of how the world functions.
What did you do at 8 years old at a drive-in movie theater?
At 8 years old, I stood on a large wooden box and made change behind the cash register. I was also responsible for bagging the corn before the doors opened. And on a really good night, my mother would send me around because it was X dollars per head, but people would stuff the car, trunks and under the seats and so forth. And it was my job, once the show had started to go around, with a flashlight and count heads and compare the license plate numbers. I learned a great deal about physical possibilities in the drive-in as an eight-year-old.
You have said that you began your career as a choreographer, as a watcher of dance. What does that mean?
Just that. I have twin brothers and a sister, and they had babysitters, and I decided that they should be a dance company. And so when I was about six or so, we would have performances, and I would watch.
And when
I thought it might be a more power position than being on the inside.
Do you remember anything about the way that you directed them at that time? Could someone have looked at you and said, this girl is going to be a choreographer?
I don't think so.
How did your study of music affect the way you relate movement to sound?
My mother was a concert pianist, actually, and she had four children, all four of us with ear training before we were a year old. Two of us have relative pitch, two have absolute pitch. So it's simply a matter of training, and I was very, very privileged. It's an extraordinary opportunity. I learned to read music as a baby, child, but through color. So because I have perfect pitch, when I hear a C, middle C, I see yellow. When I hear a D, it's red and so forth, according to how I learned through the colors in the music as a child. And I think that probably is the first cross generic, let's call it, connection that I made, which was color and sound. And since then, many of those congruencies come to me from literature, painting, history, whatever.
So you have synesthesia.
That's true.
When you listen to a piece of music, is your brain flooded with color?
It can be, but it can also be architectural. It can also be historic, if I'm listening to Bach as opposed to Ravel. It can be visual. I can see the score. It can also be strictly kinetic, in that I play a number of musical instruments and I feel the force. It's one of the reasons that I've used so much solo violin. I feel how that music's generated through the body, the movement of the bow, so forth, the pressure, the attack.
Was there a point in your life where you assumed that everyone had this and then
I still do.
Really?
Yes. That I give my audience. I attach great intelligence to my audiences. And I don't specifically expect nor think that their connections to the material are going to be mine. But I do know that people want to understand.
Why do you think some audiences for dance or would-be audiences are reluctant and somehow feel that they won't understand?
Because that's sometimes the attitude that some folks in the arts take. Some folks do see it as an elitist situation, which reflects back to their own stature, shall we say. I've always been interested in what's under the hood, and I assume my audiences are too.
How does the program that you are premiering this weekend reflect the influence of choreographers who have meant a lot to you?
How many people here? This is a polling moment. How many people here have known or are reading my blog in the New York Times? That's not enough. More of you need to check in online. Every week I am blogging for the New York Times. This tour and about these works and about why dance is important to us all and why it should be ever more important to all of you. So please check in there. But the idea, I think, in the third blog was that within the first piece on our program, there are two. The first one is called Prelude and Fugues. It utilizes the music of Sebastian Bach, the well-tempered clavier. And four of the sections that we do, we use 22 of them, four of them are specifically dedicated to choreographers who were hugely impactful for me and continue to be present. And this is not something I invented. The Beethoven Diabelli does exactly the same thing, and in a way, so does the Well-Tempered Clavier itself, because Bach had numerous antecedents, and he referenced Pach, Bell, Vivaldi, so on and so forth. It's always been a part of his tradition and mine as well that art is eclectic, that it has a very wide overreach, that it can accommodate many diverse points of view. In fact, all diverse points of view. There's nothing that's off bounds to Bach. And I like to believe the same is true of dance.
There's some comedy in the other piece.
There's a lot of comedy, we think, in the other piece. We're waiting to see what you think. We hope you'll go along with it. There is, yes, much reference to where comedy often comes, is embedded in dysfunction, political incorrectness, we might even call it, often has been used to generate humor, and that was somewhat in my mind. For the second one, I say about the evening, the first piece is called Preludes and Fugues, second one is called Yowzy. So the first one projects the world as it ought to be, and the second one does the world as it is.
Can every dancer do comedy?
No. And very few people, in fact, are willing to make great fools of themselves. You have to have a very open mind to take on that quest.
My understanding is that when you have a small number of roles or parts to assign, you might see hundreds of dancers. Assuming that anybody who gets in front of you is an elite artist, what causes a dancer to stand out in your mind?
I would say mostly their security in their desire to be doing it, to be there, to want it, to not question those things. And this will be reflected in their training. It will be reflected in their physical conditioning. It will be, I often say, reflected in how they put their bag down when they come in the door.
So you're auditioning before you've even acknowledged them?
Oh, yes.
Do they learn this later after they've been chosen?
They never learn it.
Can you see a young dancer who's working for you strictly as a dancer and see potential in that individual as a choreographer? Can you tell who might have talents as a choreographer?
Absolutely not. That is a matter of doing it.
You just have to learn it through practice.
It's not something you learn, you invent it.
Was choreography an identity for you before, as you started? Did you feel like
this is actually a sincere question. What do you mean by identity?
Did you define yourself? Is the definition of a choreographer different from the definition of a dancer, different from the definition? Does it all fall under artist, or is it something different to be a choreographer?
I think all three actually are very different categories. A choreographer is a person who makes movement in time and space, either for themselves or for others. A dancer is a person who responds to their own physical input and desires to communicate the feeling and the accomplishment of that desire to others. An artist is a person who asks questions.
We're speaking this hour with choreographer Twyla Tharp. The world premiere of Twyla Tharp's 50th anniversary tour happens Friday and Saturday at the Winspear Opera House in Dallas. We're not taking phone calls today, but you can join the show by emailing think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet @ChrisBoydThink. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with choreographer Twyla Tharp. The world premiere of the Twyla Tharp 50th Anniversary Tour happens Friday at the Winspear Opera House in Dallas as a special presentation of Titus with an encore presentation Saturday, and then it moves throughout the country. If you'd like to join the show, you can send email to think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You have said, or your dancers have said, that you value strong-minded people. How much do you want to hear from them if they disagree with you about a choice that you've made?
I don't have a choice. I will see it. If it's something that clearly makes sense to them, I have to factor that into where we're at, because I'm working with dancers and people that I respect. So also, they're on the inside, I'm on the outside. It's two very different places.
Can you tell us about the first work that you choreographed in 1965?
Of course. How much time do I have? It was called Tank Dive. It was done in a Bauhaus auditorium at Hunter College. It was not on a proscenium stage. It was in an architectural space. It lasted the entire evening, was about 4 minutes and 30 seconds, because I figured that's all I knew about a beginning and a middle and an end, and I could get it into that period of time. So if you were late, you kind of missed the whole thing. But that was okay, because I think 14 people came. And that's okay, too, because to me, one was an audience. One watcher was an audience. It was not reviewed. The next concert I did was, and this one just stood as a sort of manifesto, if you will, a kind of commitment to a practice that I was asking myself, okay, I think I can have a foundation here. Do I really? And does it also suggest the next point? Because for me, that event in itself was just beginning to knock through the ice. It wasn't as though this, and that piece has never been reconstructed and never will be. It was just the beginning point to get to the next point.
Can you explain for people who don't have a dance background how choreography is notated and how you keep track of the changes that you've made?
Choreography has a number of forms of notation. Some of it is a kind of physical shorthand, both something called Benesch and Laba notation, which are both from the 20th century. But before that, even, there are dance manuals going back to the 17th, even the 16th century. Basically, these were by footprint, the pattern of the dance in combination with the rhythm, a pavane, for example, a gavotte, how those space patterns connected to the temporal patterns, not necessarily the physical use of the body. The Benesch and the Laba notation tried to become more complicated with things like how does the body coordinate its various parts. I, as a tiny child, under my mother's tutelage, learned to write out everything longhand. And by everything, I mean everything. In tap dancing, for example, the shuffle, the ball change, the ball of the foot, the heel of the foot, the outside of the foot, all of this was written out longhand. And that is a discipline of its own and can be reconstructed. Actually, you could go back and reconstruct a tap routine. When I started making my own movement, I was looking to make movement that no one else had ever done. So there was no vocabulary for noting it. And how that happened in terms of retention was we did not retain. And the first 5 years of material basically will never be. There are a couple of pieces towards the very end of that period, one of them called Medley that was done for Central Park, and one of them called Dancing in the Streets of Paris and London, continued in Stockholm and sometimes Madrid, that was done in two museums, the Wadsworth Athenaeum and the Metropolitan in New York, that might one day be reconstructed. But for the most part, I wasn't looking for posterity in those first 5 years. I was looking for a beginning point. So reams and reams and reams of movement came out, and it is all actually written longhand. I do have it in binders, and there is actually eight or ten seconds of a piece of medley, which was from 68, that is utilized in one section of the Bach. I went back and did retro postmodernism. Yeah. So that's one way of notating. Of course, the real answer that's available now is video. And I got my first video system in 1968, and since that time have videotaped an enormous amount of material. I have a huge video archive beginning in that era and continuing to this day that traces not only a final work but the evolution of that work from the very first improv sessions through the very first rehearsals and so on and so forth. So that at some point in time, those can be edited and will exist.
You dance every day?
I move around every day, shall we say. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, I don't mean to be derogatory to myself here. That's what I always thought it was. Because dancing is a very big word. Art is a very big word. I move around. That's what I do.
When you are creating a new work, how much of what you're doing is done in solitude as you're moving around, and how much is done with other dancers as you're kind of scratching out what you think you might work with?
It depends on the piece. For the most part, I would say my schedule works. I'm usually doing my own physical regimen from about 7 until like 8:30. Then if I'm working on a piece, I'll usually start around 9:30 or so and do an hour, hour and a half on specific phrases or material constructions that I'm going to use in rehearsal that day. I like to start with the dancers by noon and we'll work the afternoon, transferring to them a version of what I did, maybe a distillation of what I did, because no longer does this body work in the vanguard of bodies, I must be honest. It can work conceptually, it can have ideas, but it's probably not jumping higher than one of my guys, it's probably not going longer, its batma is probably not as grand, et cetera, et cetera. And I just have to face that, which I do from 12 until 5. And then the next day I get up all over and pretend it ain't so.
To be honest, I can't even imagine you sleeping.
I don't do very well at that, to tell you the truth.
Is there a role for stillness in your creative process?
Sure. Ultimately, that's what it has to be. I mean, it's the center point. I mean, it all has to come to balance. There has to be a symmetry, and symmetry is silent.
How much of your success is about self-discipline?
Well, you don't get through the day without discipline, so you don't accomplish without discipline. I'm a very firm believer in schedules, discipline, and it depends on what everyone defines their own goals in life. I mean, mine has always been to maximize what I could accomplish and to maximize what I've been given, which is enormous. And I would consider it inappropriate not to work as hard as I can.
What's your definition of perfection?
Doesn't exist. I wouldn't have the vaguest idea. I mean, abstractly, do we have, you know, philosophers speaking of beauty? Do we have, you know, impossible dreams? We do. But I am less interested in those abstract concepts than in tangible reality. I'm a farm girl. I come from the Midwest.
So what are you looking for that tells you that something is right and it's ready and it's as good as it can be?
I'm really bored. When I'm really, really bored, it's done.
We were speaking earlier about the way that you don't like to break for lunch and you sort of have this rhythm to your day. What do you have to think about working with dancers when you're rehearsing a piece and how much is too much and how much is not enough?
Well, this is ultimately one is very concerned with the talent and reserve of spirit as well that is a dancer. It can never be abused, and if by accident that happens, it has to be addressed immediately. So when I'm working with a dancer and I care about the dancers that I work with, they are not pushed in any abstract way. I usually know them very well, and I know the points they understand investigating, and perhaps to some degree those they don't. And I respect those boundaries.
You also have to know that there are, if you have a company of 12 dancers, 12 different, you know, last nights. And obviously these
there are no last nights. There is only tomorrow.
Obviously these are professionals, but how much do you factor in people's moods, people's sort of emotional states, having nothing to do with the work that they're there to do for you?
I don't. We come in the door, and as we say, the baggage is left outside. I've had actually some great tragedies come through the door, and the dancers have been grateful to be expected to drop that for the moment.
Pulling together this 50th anniversary show, it doesn't seem like this is no finale for you. Are you already thinking about what comes after this?
I am.
You want to tell us?
No. No, I never have ever, from the very beginning, talked about the future because it will change a billion times, and I don't like to see myself as a liar.
Martha Graham recognized you as a sort of kindred spirit. She called you a fellow rebel. Is that about risk-taking?
I think it's about craziness. I was in the studio with Graham for 1 year, her last year teaching, and she was, I think, entertained by the fact that I like to bang into the walls.
Literally
bang into the walls. I mean, I was taking company class, and she had some great male dancers, Paul Taylor, Burt Ross. They were big men, and they traveled fast, and they pushed hard. And I would come right after them on the diagonal, and I would push harder. And they could manage to avoid the wall, and I never did, and I sort of would go splat, and I think she found that to be of some value.
All right, I was trying to lead you to a question about risk-taking, but I'm just going to go into it directly
okay.
now.
All right.
I should have known not to assume that I knew what was going to come out of your mouth. So as you have gained decades of experience, at this point, I wonder if you have to work harder to take a risk, to do something that you haven't done before, because you've done everything.
I certainly have not done everything. I think the more you work, the more you realize you're scratching the surface. And the opportunities increase. The challenges increase. Some degree of righteousness might increase, maybe a little bit, but it will always remain a gamble.
What do you mean by righteousness?
Righteousness, purpose, the right reason, the belief that you have a right to be doing what you are doing.
Is there for you a particular energy about a premiere night, an opening night that is different?
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Premiere evenings are invariably flawed, shall we say. We work very hard to make the thing itself when the curtain goes up. And obviously the more experience one has, the closer to believing that the thing is itself on its first performance will happen. I've certainly learned about rehearsing dancers in a different way over the course of years. And these guys are coming after several workshops on this evening over the course of a year and a half and six studio showings in New York with audience before they open here. They are prepared to the degree that I understand at this point in time. We still have lights to factor in. We still have wardrobe to factor in. We still have sight lines to factor in. All of these are unknowns, which we'll begin to address tomorrow. We have a great crew. Santo Loquasto is our designer. He has been working with me since the mid-70s and has done thousands of projects. And he has his expertise, which we'll bring. But there are always surprises. We hate surprises, excepting when we don't, because surprises are ultimately what it's all about. But you want to have a really strong foundation. You don't want your foundation to be the surprise. You want your upreach to be the surprise. So you must wish us luck. That's all I can tell you for opening night.
Have you already done initial walkthroughs at the Windspear?
Not yet. The company arrives this afternoon.
So you do that together?
Yeah, we begin that tomorrow. Do I? Have I been on the stage? Mm-hmm. I've been on the stage.
Obviously, every space is different. Are there some that you walk into, and I don't know if I want you to comment on the Windspear or not, but are there some that you walk into and you just deflate?
No. They're all a different challenge. Some are more difficult. Some can be really ugly, but the lights go out. That's a good thing. And ultimately, you think about the one face. You think about the one face out there in the audience.
The one face watching. And
yes, one in the audience to whom you can mean something. And the theater itself is irrelevant.
What do you want people to remember about any performance that you have created for them?
It depends on the piece. In the case of the first one on this evening here in Dallas, the Bach has a certain balance to it, and as I said, ecumenical, that it has a very big reach, that it has tolerance, that it tolerates, and that it is actually a very big, small, four-letter word, lots of love in it. It begins with a duet, which is by the end expanded, orchestrated, if you will, for the entire group. But the movement is the same, the music is the same. And the statement is that we are all larger than ourselves if we wish to be. The second piece is, we like to think, as I said, humorous, which dance sometimes has trouble with. Dance sometimes takes itself extremely seriously and implies that its audience should do the same. I think its audience should think twice about the seriousness of the human body. So we're looking forward to seeing what that response might be, and also their characters and how the characters play. It is, in essence, a theater piece.
Twyla Tharp is my guest. Up next, Titus Executive Director Charles Santos joins the conversation to talk about what it took to bring the world premiere of Twyla Tharp's 50th anniversary tour to Dallas and what this two-night event says about the commitment of North Texas to supporting the fine arts. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. I've been speaking with choreographer Twyla Tharp, who this year celebrates 50 years of creating dance with a national tour that premieres at the AT&T Performing Arts Center Friday night with an encore performance Saturday. The world premiere is presented by the dance and arts education organization Titus, and we're joined now by Titus Executive Director Charles Santos. Charles, welcome back to Think.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about how this commission came about and how Titus made the decision to be part of it.
The honest truth is I got a text from Twyla saying that she wanted to talk to me about a project, and then we hadn't chatted, and then I was at a conference, and I was talking to two of my colleagues, Meg Booth from the Kennedy Center and Linda Shelton from the Joyce, and they said, I hear we're all in. And I said, in what? And I said, that we're all going to be co-commissioners on Twyla's new work. I said, okay. She said she wanted to talk to me, and we haven't, but yeah, we're in. And then I called, our partner Doug Curtis with the center, and we were talking about this is just in line with the stuff that we want to do, and to start with someone of Twyla's stature, it was just a trifecta. It was perfect.
So, Twyla, why did you text Charles, or why did you call Charles?
because I figured that he would want to know about this, that there was a need in Dallas,
it's
and
true.
Vice versa.
I mean, obviously, there are a number of cities that potentially would want to be part of this. You've been to North Texas before. Do you see something here that you didn't see in the past?
Lovely big theaters. Right? Successful programming and, as witnessed by this audience, an ever-expanding group of folk who understand that culture is very valuable in our world for learning purposes as well as economic purposes.
We have an email here that from Lorinda that perhaps either one of you would want to answer. What qualities make a good collaborator?
You know, there's a statement that was in Twyla's book about collaboration that I always listen to, that to make a collaboration successful, it's not about the size of the organizations, it's about the equality of what everyone brings to the table. Our partnership with the AT&T Performing Arts Center, they're a much bigger organization than Titus Presents, but we're equal partners, and we recognize that we're equal partners regardless of our organizational size, and that's why it works, is that we are equal partners. So, you know, with Twyla and the five commissioners, we are equal partners in this process, and we just continue to recognize that equality.
Twyla, what do you see as the role of a commissioner beyond, obviously, financially making it possible?
That there are two things. One, a genuine belief in what we do, because it's not just about the financial support. It is about the enthusiasm and the intelligence of the supporting organization. And then that will make it possible for the commissioner to reach out to their audience and mean it. I like sincerity and I like honesty.
Charles, have you seen an evolution in the audience for dance in North Texas?
Oh, absolutely. This is an exciting time in North Texas, and I think with the arts district in the state that it's in now, with the center working so well and everyone is sort of learning to play in the same sandpit, collaborations are happening more and more, and interesting projects are happening. The discussions I hear about the future are interesting. The fact that we're doing this commission with Twyla and the other commissioners is an important statement that artists are looking to Texas, and this work will carry our name everywhere it goes, and that's important that people recognize that art is important in Dallas.
What played into the decision to do the world premiere here, or what's called the world premiere? You said you'd had some preview performances.
Charles, relatively late in the game, came forward with the opportunity to be first in line, which is a gamble. And he believed that he had the facilities to mount the thing when it's just a glimmer in the future. He hasn't seen this. Oops, sorry. And that can be a little nerve-wracking. The other commissioners who follow will have seen it, for better or for worse, and that will give them a foot up. He doesn't have that foot up. He's stepping high into thin air doing this, and I applaud that.
What are the risks for you stepping high into thin air?
Everything.
Yeah. go for it,
you know,
Charles,
but
I say.
I'm a big believer that presenters, Titus is a presenter, you know, we're not a dance company. You have to have a commitment to risk. You have to be able to be willing to make an audience uncomfortable, to push their limits and make them see things and potentially offend them, and that's okay. I have great confidence in the work. I've seen the workshops. I strategically planned for this world premiere because I knew where they were planning on doing it, and I knew that it was still in negotiation. I spoke to Doug. We magically had this week opened in the Opera House, and so I said, you know, if this other organization falls through, we would love to have the world premiere, and it all worked out.
Who has influence over what gets funded and produced and seen beyond the artists themselves?
Well, the presenters, for sure. I told my board when they hired me, you hire me for my taste or you hire someone else. It's really the truth. You have to be willing as a presenter to, you know, to put your experience, life experience out there. So I spent a lot of time looking at work. It's a balancing act between giving an audience what they want to see, the known companies, as opposed to the new companies. This season, we have 10 companies in the season. nine of which have never been here. So it's a year of debuts and two world premieres, and that's a big risk. But it seems to be exciting, and I think we have to do this. Next year, we won't be quite so risky. We'll have a few more known entities, but you have to trust the artists that you want to work with, that they're going to bring really great work. So it's a constant balancing act, and it's also admitting the truth that you really don't know it all. The field is changing all the time, and so you have to constantly go out and find the new work.
What makes a city a draw for people who are creating art to live and work here?
What? Am I answering that, or are you pointing to me?
Because you live here, and I'm a
latecomer here.
Well,
I think what's interesting right now, like I say, Dallas is, I think, becoming very interesting. There is a wealth of resources, of studio spaces, of funders, of community members that are wanting to develop work. So for someone like me, I love presenting. The thing that I enjoy the most is commissioning new works and sort of having a hand in that process. So this community seems to be very willing to step up and not only, write a check, but help us find a space, help us find the connections to make the tour happen. For the artists, I think for artists, they just want to connect with a city that is interested in being a part of that process.
Anything you would add, Twyla, in general, what causes certain metropolitan areas to really be draws for people who are working artists?
Well, obviously, when you're putting a tour together, you want houses and you want audiences. But there are those communities that do develop a sense of openness. In the early 70s, when we were first beginning to tour, we went quite often to Minneapolis. And this was a community that I felt very open, both because of its museum, but also because of its theater groups. And not biased, not jaded, not opinionated. And these are fantastic audiences. I mean, I am going on this tour all 10 weeks to reintroduce myself with various communities across this country, because there's no other way to know how people think. And I know from time that has been spent in Dallas that Dallas can be open-minded as well. And an open-minded audience is a very special thing. A biased audience, we know who they are. We understand that very, very well. And we know how they will react. The open audience is like, yes, my grandson, 5 years old in 10 months, who came recently to a rehearsal, and he comes with no bias. He comes completely open, willing to be shown. These are the audiences that you want. To have the enthusiasm and the intelligence also to be as gorgeous, but never mind that. We don't often see faces from the front of the house, but you feel a quest. You feel an audience who wants to see it work, as opposed to an audience who comes in and perhaps is not so sure they want to see it work.
How do you give people permission to express whatever emotional response they have to a piece?
I think that laughter is one of the best sources. I learned that fairly early. One of my very first stage pieces, maybe my very first, was called Eight Jelly Rolls, with music by Jelly Roll Morton. And that's referenced, actually, in Yowzie. And I don't know how I got the idea, probably from the cartoons at the drive-in, that if an audience could laugh, it would free up their heads from being judgmental, and they would respond more honestly, emotionally, because they would surprise themselves.
What do you expect to be doing for the next several days, Charles, as the company is sort of making itself
sure
at home in the theater?
Making sure everything's where Twyla wants it. No, it's in motion. We were talking about this earlier. We have a great marketing team at the center that Titus works with, and everything's in motion. And I'm sort of the opinion, it's out there. It will be what it will be. We're doing everything we can. I think we're going to have a great audience. I've seen the works. Twyla's work interests me on so many different levels, but I love that she has worked on so many different genres of the dance world, Broadway and film and TV and the concert stage and bringing all that together. Having seen these two works, I see the influence of all those parts of her career in the works that she's going to premiere. So I'm excited. You know, I woke up this morning going, okay, it's Twyla week.
Did you wake up that way too, Twyla?
No, I wake up, buy tickets. Buy tickets. Buy tickets. Buy tickets.
I don't know how either of you feel about this question. This room is filled with people who care about the arts, who care about dance. We may have people listening who have never considered attending a dance performance before.
Try us first.
What do you say to people who want to know whether they will, in a manner of speaking, get their money's worth, enjoy themselves, relate to what you are bringing here?
That it's something I think about, too. I do believe that we have a trust with an audience, that an audience comes wanting to see something, hoping to see something, perhaps even expecting to see something that will connect to them. And that means a great deal to me. I do think of it as a contract with the audience.
You know, I think a lot of people get intimidated by dance, that they have to have some sort of base knowledge for dance, and they just don't. I love it with our gala that Twyla's also participated in, that people walk out of there going, I had no idea. This was so great. You know, loved the dancing was so great. And I just want people to come and just sort of experience it and realize that there is no, you don't have to go get a sort of an undergraduate degree in dance appreciation or something before you can enjoy a ballet or a program like what Twyla's bringing.
It's funny that dance is one of those things that people will do. They will actually do it in the way that they wouldn't get up and sing in public. Sometimes people will dance at a wedding or a party, but only when the occasion is allowing for it. Do you feel like people maybe should dance more?
I think the word allow is one that becomes relevant. Again, to reference the expert in all things of my life, my grandson, he has no need to be given permission to dance. He just bops around all the time. That will probably be taken away from him as he becomes more educated, which is too bad, because if people responded instantly and viscerally, first of all, everybody would feel much better. Everybody would be emotionally much clearer. And there's a great honesty to the body. And the body does not lie. It can be trained almost to lie, but it never can quite really. Words will. And therefore, dancing is a very, very good way of communicating exactly what you mean and not taking it on the chin, because nobody will get it, but except for the few who will. There will always be those who can see the truth, and there will be many who want to be told linguistically what the truth is. Learn to look for it yourself.
Do you have an urge with your grandson to turn his passion for movement into something more formal, a more formal course of study?
Absolutely not. No. He should become a doctor or a lawyer.
Twyla Tharp, Charles Lantos, thanks so much, both of you, for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Titus presents the world premiere of Twyla Tharp 50th Anniversary Tour happens Friday and Saturday at the Winspear Opera House in Dallas. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.